Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Drums a little more slowly, a little more somberly. For those of you who do not follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, it is a sad and somber evening. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com is our home, and it is truly our home online. Because we are a family. I kid around about the Horn Family Commune Congregation, but it really is a community. And we have lost a member of that community. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy, in Vermont, for letting me know that we're reaching loud and clear, says Jeremy. Thank you. I was up late last night. I tend to be a bit of a night owl anyway. When word reached me via Facebook that our dear friend, beloved, even. Bill, Mr. Stress Miller, had, at some point in time, this past Monday, the 18th of May, passed away. Born January the 1st, 1943, he was 72 years old, almost exactly 72 and a half years old. Information I received said only that he died of complications from long-standing illnesses. I checked. I checked back to see if there, and no, he had not tried to call the program on Monday because I was afraid perhaps, you see, once Bill had reached out, well, Bill had a stroke on the air back in 2013, and swift action by members of the Horn family saved his life that evening. You know who you are. And I was terrified of the idea that he might have tried to reach out again and I didn't get to his call. That was not the case. I was left stunned when I found the news early this morning or late last night, depending on what kind of nomenclature one prefers. And, oh, I don't guess I got to sleep until about 6 a.m. Too much imagery. Too much sorrow in my system for that. This is, of course, Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2015. It would be a prayer meeting Wednesday, but we will put aside the prayer meeting Wednesday shenanigans in considering and celebrating the life of Bill Miller and enjoying, as many of you did, because, you know, I used to get fan mail. Bill would get fan mail from you guys to my account, and I'd try to share as much of it on the air as I could. We had a long and enjoyable conversation. Most people, and he was an institution in Cleveland long before he ever found this program and engaged in the conversation. He had an abiding, as you know, love of history and culture, and said on a number of occasions, which you may recall, that had things turned out differently, he might have been a teacher. Well, in many ways, with his calls to this program, he got to live out his dream, because he did teach and inform through conversation, through dialogue here. His last appearance on the program was this past Friday on the front porch. But you can, over the last, 4 years, you can find him all over the Horn archives. Our buddy Isaac made a little recording way back in June of 2012 of Bill and I in conversation about Trombone Shorty and George Clinton. I really appreciate Isaac sending that along. I thought it would be appropriate to share something in the way of a clip of Bill's participation in the program. Let's take a second and just sort of look back and appreciate and enjoy the wit and wisdom of Mr. Stress.
All right, good night.
All right, bye now. Dr. John calling from New York. Onward we go. Line's open if you want to jump in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
Pretty good, Bill. How about you?
You know, I can't complain. Nobody listens, you know. Well, yeah, the shrink will listen and the bartender will listen, but they both cost an awful lot, you know. That's one of those things. But seriously speaking, could you run by those dates by me again on the history?
The American History Prism series?
Yeah.
July 2nd and 3rd?
Yep.
5th and 6th?
Okay.
And 9th?
Okay. Yeah, it's nice to get a free education.
And this is that, Bill. It absolutely is.
Those guys know their stuff.
I mean, we'll be starting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and some evenings we may not finish up till 9.
Oof. See, I'm weak in the revolutionary and constitutional period. After that, I got... You know, that's Civil War. You start looking at that, and it's like opening up a big river because there's so many other aspects. And learning is funny that way. I got so heavily involved in listening to New Orleans jazz, which you begin to learn a lot of social things from, like the New Orleans funeral. First of all, a lot of people buried with music in those days, a lot of different groups. And a lot of it in New Orleans came from the fact that getting life insurance was not easy if you were black.
Right.
And you belonged to your lodge, and the part of the lodge insurance was the use of a band. And I have a great recording by this young Tuxedo Brass Band that Ernigan sent Tommy Dowd to New Orleans in 59. And they recorded these guys, and they young. Are you kidding me? These guys were pretty darn old then. But, man, and the clarinetist uses an E-flat clarinet because it carries outside strongly. It's a high, you know, high-pitched.
Right.
And you being of Scotch descent, you'd get the screaming like, that reminds me of a bagpipe.
Yeah, true. But, yeah, like the business part of a bagpipe.
Yep. Yeah, the tonality is wailing. This guy was named John Kazmir, who was leading the band at that time and playing the E-flat. And what a sound. There's a lot of great bands down there now. Trombone Shorty. And there's a program on college radio here in Cleveland on Monday morning called Fat Monday, P-H-A-T. And they, when I wake up listening to the guys I have on record that have been dead since 65, and you never thought you'd hear them on a radio channel. You know, I have a good collection of that stuff. I should sell it. But you're going to be gone a long time. I'll miss the hell out of you, Bob.
There will be reruns, Bill.
Yeah.
But.
Well, it has to be done, man. Bless you, because you hit it right on the head. And I had some interesting encounters with young men from West Virginia in the 1950s, mid-50s. Some of them weren't real friendly. But, hey, none of them ever resorted to guns and clubs either. You know, it was that typical, let's play football in the middle of the game, somebody will throw a punch at somebody, you know, that kid stuff. Typical.
Well, but again, you know, this kind of goes back to, I mention him a lot because I miss him horribly, Joe Bajant. You know,
yeah.
you can go to joebajant.com and just spend days there. But that one brilliant essay that he wrote called Eat, Pray, Fight.
Yeah.
Is an exploration of what it is to be Southern and Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
And to try to understand why it is that many of us will throw a punch as quick as look.
Well, Senator Webb, you know.
Yeah, said much the same thing.
Yeah, I mean.
But if you want writing style, there's no beating Joe.
Oh, no, absolutely. And the people he hung with out there in Colorado, and what did he do? Denver? He was out there with some of the old Beat Generation people who were out there.
Oh, yeah. New Timothy Leary, new Dr. Thompson. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great place to go. He wasn't a writer when he went out there, was he, really?
No, he was, he had a hint that he wanted to, but it wasn't the origin. He was just kind of being a young guy at loose ends and trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life after getting out of the Navy. I think that's how it went. Couldn't hardly bear to go back and you know go up Shanghai Road and live there.
And
carved out a niche for himself and did so brilliantly. Like I said, there is if you just start with one and start following the links.
I heard some of the interviews he did. I got those off the net.
Well, somewhere back there, and I searched when we heard that he had passed away. I searched my emails. I asked other people to search their emails. Joe Bajant remains to this day the only individual in the history of the Horn to whom I have ever given the entire body of a show. And there is somewhere in the archives, if anybody wants to go searching, there is a 3-hour conversation with Joe Bajant that is, I was rapt.
Well, you're strong on the mark yourself in the recent couple of Obsters. You've been really, what's the song, Preach and Teach, buddy?
Yes, and you know, somebody, the choir needs preaching too sometimes.
Well, we all have to have it reinforced because sometimes I'm getting so to the point of depression with this whole society that I start thinking, well, what do I do? Just go out and pick some guy out I don't like? Smack. them and get it over with. Because it's just getting tough to listen to these people.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, Bill. You're not a psychopath, so you are. So even though you might think about it, you will, because you have a well-functioning brain, talk yourself out of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I carry...
Under most circumstances.
I carried for quite a few years, depending where I was living in the city, in certain neighborhoods that were, you know... I came home from doing a job one night, and I'm getting out of my vehicle. I'm getting some dog and cat food out of the side of my van. I was driving a van in those days, and I turned and whirled around, and there's four guys, construction crew. They had hammers. Big monkey wrenches. Of course, it was 3:30 in the morning. And the guy says, well, we're righteous. And I said, well, you want to stay that way too, don't you? Because I was pointing at him. Who the hell are you? 3:30 in the morning in the inner city of Cleveland. And these guys were all Caucasian, by the way, in case anybody's wondering. So, you know, it's got nothing to do. Ethnicity's got nothing to do with this kind of stuff.
No.
Idiots come and desperate people come in all shapes, sizes, and one of these days I'll meet from one from Mars if I keep listening to that Nori at night, you know. You never know. Well, my mother had some books in the early 50s by some guy who lived on the slopes of Mount Palomar. I can't think of his name. Flying saucers have landed inside the spaceships. And they were quite interesting when I was like 13 or so because some of these people that he was bumping into were really... very, very nice creatures. They had an ethic to them that, you know, the same one that Palestinian day laborer had.
Right. Stop hating on each other. Stop killing each other.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And I have a real hard time. I got a kick out of Jim. He's a show music listener and classical music. My sister was the complete opposite of me. Classically trained mezzo who listened to the opera every Saturday, and so did I because it was loud. And in the show music, I used to sit when I was messing with clarinet and play Get Me to the Church on Time and some of these other show tunes just for something to dabble with. One of my proudest jobs was in 75. We did two shows on a Sunday afternoon. You know, one where they clear the house between sets?
Yeah.
Shows? With Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, wow.
Oh, she was something else.
Yeah.
She grabbed my guitar player at that point in time and was trying to get him back to come back to the hotel with her. And this was a great guy. He said, no, I got to take care of all this equipment. I thought to myself, you moron, you. But that's another story. I think she was someone that she was going to try to talk him into down the road and playing for her.
Yeah, gigging.
Yeah, because he was that damn. That kid was he was 17 when we opened for Cream at Grandy Ballroom in Detroit, and he was using a Sears 610 Dan Electro amp. Dan Electro was the guy who built it, marketed under the Sears name. They were great amps. They were really strong.
Oh, yeah. I'm well familiar with the brand.
Yeah. You know, it was just a strange time, and I look back at it now and said, you know, I sometimes say, man, if you had been born into a middle-class household, you'd have had a history degree and, you know, hopefully taught at some small college or high school or something, and retirement would be a lot easier than, you know, because, man, I miss playing like crazy. But a lot of blues up here now, but a lot of these guys never, ever listened to anybody, you know, except late model stuff.
Yeah. No, you got to go back to the roots, don't you?
That's where the guys like me who started in the mid-60s professionally and even earlier amateurishly, so to speak, we had one hand deep in that market, deep in those in Muddy and Chess, and it was, the blues was all over the country. The stylistic differences are fantastically. The Texas guys ended up in Oklahoma, guys immigrating out to Oakland, and then meeting another Caucasian wild man. In this case, Johnny Otis. This guy, Louisiana Red, did you ever hear him?
I don't think so.
He did an LP in the early 60s, and it was real folkish from the effect that one of his songs was Red's Ride, and it was chronicle of the reverse freedom ride that he was offered. You know, Citizens Committee giving away the fare. If you don't like the South Boy, go on away from here.
Yeah.
Somebody got to Little Rock, and they gave me. I got bought something to eat, but when I got my sandwich, I had to eat it on the street. You know, there was a story there.
You know, that reminds me, you having the, I didn't realize this was coming out, but you having the literary and musical bent that you do, this might mean something to you, Bill. And I know your vision is compromised, but still, I've wondered for a long time when this would actually be done, and apparently it has been. Not a lot of reviews out there yet, but here, I think in a few weeks, lo and behold, on the road, Kerouac,
yeah,
is going to be released as a film, a major feature motion picture.
Oh, man, great, great. It's about time.
Well, it is. It is. The question being, did they do the book justice? Did they do the era justice? And is it more than, you know, looking at faded photographs, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. I had that weird birthday of the mid-war, and I was a radio kid growing, you know, the first 5 or 6 years before we even had a television. And, you know, I was, these kids that I was hanging with calling themselves hippies, and they said, oh, you old beat you. And I was fixing to give me a hard time about being a little older than them, you know. But, yeah, he said so much, and he caught, of course, he ended up pretty conservative in his old age, didn't he?
Well, he didn't have an old age.
Yeah, he was like 47, I think.
But he turned into this hard right-wing Vietnam-supporting drunk.
Oh, yeah.
And wound up dying of some sort of massive hemorrhage after eating living with his mother in Florida, and died of a massive hemorrhage after eating a one-pound can of tuna or something.
Jeez. Of course, where there was stuff that might be in that, you know. I'm getting to a point, Bob, where everything, I've gone back to using a bread machine, baking my own bread again. My grandmother baked it, but she did it the old-fashioned way, you know.
Oh, I understand. This is not some sort of elitism, but after my little jaunt across the pond, I can't find a loaf of bread anywhere that even begins to compare. I mean, I've joked about the beer and everything, and it is amazing. But really, the lasting impression is the bread.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is the staff of life. And if you sit down with 2 or 3 slices of that out of a toaster and a little butter and maybe some cheese or meat or just jam and butter.
Yeah.
One, the jam is not going to be made with high fructose corn syrup. The butter is not going to be made with bovine recombinant growth hormone milk. And the bread is not going to be made with GMO grains. And that bread is, by God, Bill, bread. I mean, it's dense, and it's rich, and it's flavorful, and it's not this gluey, cellulose-laden stuff that comes in a bag called the marked Wonder, because it's a wonder the human system can digest it.
Yeah, why is that? We have the same sense of humor. My line was, you wonder if it's bread or not.
Yeah, it's a wonder anybody can eat it.
Yeah, exactly. We're a couple of sick humorists, I'll tell you.
But no, I mean, I had that for breakfast every morning over there.
Oh,
and you know, I'm somebody who likes to get up and, by God, have breakfast. And guess what? I felt like I had. By the way, you got some email in from Isaac. Isaac is a friend with a friend of George Clinton's.
Oh, my God.
And he said, Bill mentioned Trombone Shorty.
Yeah.
Bill has great taste. His real name is Troy Andrews, and he has done some shows with George.
Huh?
Great talent. In fact, it took me a minute to recognize the name. But you might remember some time back I was going down and doing broadcasts at West Virginia State University for our friends at Seneca 2. Well, at one point in time, they had either just gotten done or were about to host Trombone Shorty in a show there at West Virginia State.
Oh, my.
And it took me a minute for that light to go on, but yeah.
It's good to see these younger, you know, the Marcellus brothers, their dad, Ellis, was a piano teacher in New Orleans, and he jammed it down these guys' throats as to where they came from and the tradition of that city. And those guys could actually play older-style jazz convincingly when you consider how much education they've had, you know, musical education. That's one of the differences.
Oh, like, yeah, the real old-school stuff, the Big Spiderbeck.
Well, the guy I liked was this clarinetist named George Lewis. And when they rediscovered this trumpet player, Bunk Johnson, they put him with George's band. And hell, George was in Europe quite a bit. There was an YouTube of him and Acker Bilk doing Carina, the two clarinets just winding. Because Bilk was the guy who tried to steal George's style, you know, Stranger on the Shore. The big vibrato in there, that's New Orleans clarinetist. The French clarinet teacher could be pulling that hair out. Because it's so contrary to what classical players were taught.
Oh, without a doubt.
Although New Orleans, before Plessy and Ferguson took good hold, there was a Creole of color philharmonic or symphonic orchestra in New Orleans also. And then people were, you know, it's a whole different society that, you know, I had trouble as a kid because I was living in an integrated neighborhood, and I helped make it that way. And, you get on we were running trackless trolleys in those days, and you get on, and you sat next to anybody. And when all this stuff hit the fan, you know, with this integration, I just couldn't understand what the problem was. No problem for me, you know. I went and sat and talked, and whoever the person was, you know, Jesus. Because it's a shame, because I have a problem, Bob, sometimes with people with a Southern accent, and I don't like to, because, you know, it's not that way with everybody.
No, but when you hear so much ignorance being pronounced with it, it's hard not to associate one with the other.
Yeah, and it's a shame, because it shouldn't. I often ask myself how the Southern working class man could go out and charge cannon and mass musketry so that some rich guy could have a better shot, you know?
Right.
That's a crime, because these were some of the bravest. Who did the movie Gettysburg based on Killer Angels?
Was it Shiraz's book?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know Ted Turner had a hand in the production of it.
That was the guy, yeah. And, man, did that open my eyes to what I had been only able to visualize a lot in my mind as to what these guys did. How they did it, I'll never know. Well, of course, then again, I just lost my father-in-law, my second wife's father. He was on Saipan and Tinian and Iwo. And he broke his sons a few years ago into some of the things that he saw and didn't like done by American Marines. And he said the kids told me it was real tough for him to talk about things that he saw that were done to wounded people and prisoners and such that were not, you know, not what we're taught, you know.
Right.
Because that situation, anything's liable to happen.
And in the midst of war, no one has a lock on, on morality.
You spent some time in Cleveland with your dad at the clinic, didn't you?
I did.
Well, I heard you speak of that. I've been in there. They've done a little work on me.
No, they saved my. There's no getting around. They bought my father another 10 years.
They know what they're doing. They've had some problems, believe it or not, with some staph infections and such, which makes you wonder about certain aspects. And I could tell you a good story, but I won't tonight. But a friend of mine who was an electrician there, that I heard from him that hit the papers.
Well, my father was there, Bill, at a time when some sheikh or emir or sharif or whatever had an entire floor, and this was a nice thing to me. The whole hospital smelled of roasted lamb and various, you know, various other Middle Eastern delicacies. And it was delightful.
Well, if you came out of the clinic walking onto Euclid Avenue and made a right turn and walked three-quarters of a mile in the late 50s, early 60s, you would have been in the middle of our version of Storyville up here.
Really?
Well, that's where I was hanging out when I was 17. Great organ trios. And, you know, and if you minded your own business and didn't bother anybody, nobody messed with you. That was a different situation. And I don't know what's happened in our society now that we reach a point in so many areas of life where desperate people do desperately stupid things.
Well, I think there's that, but to a certain extent, in unofficial ways, there's a lot to point to the idea that this country is rapidly resegregating itself.
Yeah.
When you know, and officially as well, when you've got Southern senators of the United States saying, my state don't need to be regulated by the Voting Rights Act. We ain't lynched nobody in forever.
And you and I know that the things that Dr. King fought for in the 64 Civil Rights Bill had been in the Constitution since the post-Civil War era.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They were nothing new. They were things that were supposed to be a part of everybody in this society. that area was a great one. And we also have a big market house up here which is celebrating 100th anniversary. City built it. And when they first laid it out, they were going to put in baths and washrooms because of the, it was opened 100 years ago this year. And that's how primitive it was in a big city. There was still a bathhouse on the route I took to my 8th grade school. Because at one point in my life, I was using the recreation center. Because the place I was living, my landlord, who was a friend of mine, he never bothered to do any plumbing work. And I wasn't about to do it for him. It's his house, you know. I did enough of my own when I owned him. Yeah, it was, so they're loaded with, they did a special on PBS up here. And the bakeries you talk about, there's one German place, I buy there some of their rye bread, is just out of this world. And there's a woman who makes sourdough rye, which is...
Yeah.
I was thinking of Tracy the other week. I was coming back in a cab, and I had there's a young woman I have for an health aide who's as old as my daughter, and she's amazed by me. She says, you know, I work with people, with older folks. I haven't met one like you yet. I said, get ready. You're going to see a whole lot of them. When the boomers start to come into retirement, you know.
Right.
Because that whole 60s era was a different world, man. But anyway, I said something to my health aide about the 1%ers. And this young woman, well, I don't know, young, she's in her 50s, cab driver, just left to the defense of the Republican Party. I said, boy, keep talking. Your tip's getting smaller by the minute here, lady. it's hard for me to deal with. And one of my best friends who grew up with...
But you know what? I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, Bill, because the fact of the matter is, it's a tactic they use. I got a right-wing blast email from Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippistan, just yesterday, I think, saying, here is coffee you can drink without running the risk of supporting any liberals.
Yeah, I know Schultz has a big coffee sponsor. And a lot of people don't like Ed, but from the standpoint of the unions, he does that part of his work well. That's all he can do, fine. Stay with it.
Yeah.
Everybody needs the kind of... I mean, your stuff, I wish to... God, well, I hate to talk about this guy that I don't think exists, but hopefully somebody that people could hear more of your work. I love the conversation style. That's, you know, I get on with some of these folks, you got to cram everything in real quick to get something across.
Yeah, you wind up feeling like an auctioneer.
Yeah, exactly. I was with someone on the West Coast last week. They were talking about voting rights, and about 30 years ago, I knew a bunch of people who were still talking about, in their mind, only landowners should vote. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that was a constitutional issue.
Yeah, it most assuredly was, and that was the way the Constitution was originally constituted.
Who fought to get that changed?
Well, There was that dust up in 1860.
Oh.
But no, I mean there was the one that the teabaggers and the right wingers really love to harp on now is that they want to go back to when folks didn't get to vote for no senators. When the Senate was properly appointed by the state government, the way the framers and founders and Jesus intended them to be.
Yeah, leave Jesus out of it. He wasn't at the convention, was he?
He was there in every spirit and every soul, Bill.
Okay. I know if he came through the airport today, he'd get arrested.
Absolutely. No, yeah, you mentioned tips running downhill in a hurry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, turnabout is fair play. And you know who this Russell Pierce character was. He was the lawmaker who was bosom buddies with that Kobach creep from Kansas and was instrumental in ramming through SB 1070 in Arizona.
Which is?
The papers please law.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he got booted out of the Senate. He was recalled.
Yeah, okay, now I know that you're
I mean, right. this guy is a fellow traveler with various and sundry skinheads, knuckleheads, right-wingers, Nazis, you know, real Nazis. That are not used as a generically critical term. Real, you know, goose-stepping, right.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. You remember George Lincoln Rockwell, of
course. Oh, sure. Well, here's a little case of turnabout is fair play. And if you can imagine the gall of doing this, for starters, he wants to get back into the Senate. And so he's got him an election campaign going to get reelected to the Senate, Russell Pierce does. And part of me goes, part of me thinks I'm ashamed of being happy about this. But the other part of me says, you know what? Revenge is a dish that is best served cold.
Yeah.
And so he was trying to find somewhere to have himself a little campaign fundraiser event. You know where this pasty-faced, doughy moron went, Bill?
Mm.
Mexican restaurants.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Good place to eat.
Now, what else did he assault while in office? Public schools. So he also went to a public school library, trying to find somewhere, on the cheap, of course, to have himself a campaign fundraiser. And the two Mexican restaurants and the one school library said, you know what? You might want to be going and campaigning somewhere else.
Good. Good. About time that somebody once in a while tells these people the same crap they hand to everybody else.
Well, that was my thought.
And you know, and I won't keep it but another minute, but you know what the school thing is about. It's not just about wages. It's about sneaking Jesus in the back door.
Well, beyond that, it's also about the general desire of a whole lot of white people in this country to eliminate any sort of social safety net, public commons things, if they have the least suspicion that those public commons might be accessed by people not quite as white as they.
They are, yeah.
There was an overt attempt to destroy public school systems in the immediate aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
With the white flight and the creation of all those Southern academies.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that too. And as I say, it's a shame because it's, you know, like there are certain country musicians that they just hit me hard. Marty Robbins did a thing called "Don't Worry About Me" back about 1960 with a fuzz tone in it, and that was the first time I'd ever heard that thing being done. You know, and he could sing. That man could sing. Well, you worked for Phillips, and he had a slew of white guys that could sing.
Oh,
and, before
a few
that,
of them,
you know. Yeah, before that he was recording blues, a lot of it. And I won't keep you, but it's just, you know, do your damnedest out there, because this situation, that Maria Gano, that situation was enough to, there's a hole in my wall about the size of my head, I think. After I heard that story, I said, Jesus God, what is with these people?
Yeah, and so far there's been utterly no remorse manifested by Representative Lamborn or any of the other godless, soulless, motherless Republicans who pulled that filthy stunt.
Yeah. Well, someday we'll have to sit and talk. I met Dennis when he was about 19, Dennis Kay, and what a guy he was. I mean, he knew this city, and He admired a guy named Tom Johnson, who was mayor here in the early 1900s, who was a millionaire, but didn't act like one. And Dennis really respected this guy's work, and what they tried to do to him to get him recalled was he wouldn't give up our municipal light plant to let the private plant dominate the whole place totally.
Well, remember when he refused to sell off the muni, not only that, but the mob put out a hit on him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another side of my life that my dad's brother worked for the fellas. I remember going to his house in about 49 and 50. I'm a little kid, and there's six slot machines there. And my uncle made my dad put money in them before he let me play them. Nice family, you know. I laughed so hard at those two guys. They were good friends.
Yeah, I guess you saw where Henry Hill passed away, right?
Oh, yeah, somebody was just talking about that. And the story that we were discussing that was, that the guy Hill worked for was not that big a man, was not that big in the group.
Yeah, it was the Lucchese family, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what was his name? Paulie. He had a good-sized crew and such, but he was not, you know.
That far up the food chain?
Yeah. And I remember that thing that happened in Appalachia. Yeah. What do they call up in New York State? When those guys were having a meeting at...
It was Appalachia, Pennsylvania, or Appalachia, New York?
New York.
Yeah.
And some guy cruising past all these Lincolns and Cadillacs with all these young guys standing out there laughing and joking. And there was a scene where some of these guys were trying to run through the woods. It would have been hilarious watching guys with expensive suits and, you know, Stetson shoes running through.
Right.
Muddy Woods would have been hilarious in itself, you know. But anyway, you go ahead, because I'm sure I hope there's a bunch of people. And thanks for those dates, because, man, that's one thing I ain't gonna miss that. I mean, anytime I had some friends that went to Case, and I used to go down, and Bill Randall used to teach communications, and I'd go down there and check him out because of his, he was somebody I listened to in 55 a lot. He brought Elvis to Cleveland in 55 to a high school. And he came to hear me one time, and that was a thrill, believe me, when you see a guy that had as much knowledge of music as he had, and to see him sitting in an audience in a bar that you, some of these bars I played in, you look around and you say, man, I wouldn't come in here for a drink. This place looks too rough for me. I'm out of here. Anyway, have the best trip possible.
Well, thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk when we get back.
Take care, sir.
All right, and bye now.
Bill Miller, the one, the only, the inimitable, the irrepressible, Mr. Stress. It wasn't that long ago that I was talking on this program about the fact that we put these archives up, and Ben Birch maintains them at whiterosesociety.org, and we put them up so that people can listen to the program at their leisure. But behind all of that, and by the way, thank you, Isaac. Thank you so kindly for the clip. That was vintage Mr. Stress. And I really appreciate you sending it along. But I was talking about the fact that this is more than just, you know, if you want to download 17 shows because you're driving across the country, you can do that. This is a time capsule. This is a postcard from what, you know, the past is constantly being created, as is the future. This is a postcard from the past to the future. And Bill is part of that postcard. Emails rolling in. Steve noting, it's used too often, but surreal fits right now, listening to his voice. I've gotten a lot of emails from Steve over the years talking about how much he cherished Bill Miller's conversations. Danny, down in Louisiana, Stan, says, I, too, am very saddened to hear that Bill has died. He was part of the family commune long before me. I'm sitting in a vet's office with one of my cats when you announced his death. I verbally gasped, though I have my earplugs in, and no one knows what I'm responding to. He was such a font of history, willingly sharing of so many of his stories, and just a decent damn man. I only regret what all I never heard him say, as I was too late to the program. You and the Horn were clearly his family. Such tragic news. Do you know much of his history, where he came from, etc., all that I missed? So sad to hear his death, but glad you're paying an homage to him. Thanks, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Bill created a sort of audio archive online autobiography for himself via our conversations. You heard some of that in the clip. Born in a tough section of Cleveland and grew up in the projects. He knew what integration was before integration was a thing. And as he pointed out, it wasn't an issue for him because he didn't bring baggage to the table. And he fell in love, of course, with an art form, a music form, that had been pioneered by people of color. And that informed his life. So, over the course of years, Bill Miller, Mr. Stress, has sent a postcard to the future. Questions of where it's going, where it will be, and a little bit about where he has been. I found out earlier today the memorial service. Bill will be cremated. His remains will be cremated. Bill's gone. His remains will be cremated, and there will be a memorial at his home bar where he played. He was the house band for well over a decade, the Euclid Tavern in Cleveland, Ohio. It will be Tuesday, June the 2nd, from, I believe, 6:30 to 10. And folks might want to, if you're in the Cleveland area, you might want to mark that date on your calendar and go pay your respects. Texas Betsy noting, I remember the night I talked to him for over half an hour waiting while I patched him through to you. Lovely man. He was indeed. He was indeed. And when the news broke earlier today over on Facebook, Carol Baker chimed in and said, I'm throwing $25 over. I think Bill would get a kick out of it if we all had a show on him. And that has been a tremendous response. Tremendous indeed. And thanks go out for remembering Bill to Mo Liberal, to Brother Deacon Asa, to Carol. To Jenny in Wisconsin. To Harold. Thank you, Harold. Thank you very much. To Chris in Germany. To our buddy Horst. To Texas Betsy. Thank you, one and all. Email coming in from Darlene. Just one word. Tears. Tears indeed. But by the same token, if you've been listening for a while and you heard Bill in the last couple of years, oh, and by the way, Irish Dave pointing out that apparently B.B. King needed an awesome harp man. I thought about the same thing. Two great blues performers gone on. Every great blues guitar player needs a great harp man. So, So we'll take time out. We'll take time out for a second, and I've got a studio clip from his disc that he kindly provided to me, and it is about a million miles past appropriate to the moment. Jim with an email, he says, "Well done, well said, and sadly missed. An extinguished light not to be seen again. R.I.P. Mr. Stress, Jim." I was actually thinking of Bill when I saw the news early this morning. I was sitting up late. I'm a night owl. It's kind of hard to just turn everything off and go to sleep after the program's over because it's usually pretty energetic. And so I had been watching on Netflix a BBC series called Our World War. And the first segment of it is about the first British action in that conflict. And, of course, you know that Bill was an absolute voracious consumer of history. And I was sitting there thinking after I'd watched it, because they did a brilliant job of showing, even in microcosmic scale, how horrible that conflict was. That at the beginning there was a line that said, "Modern warfare is unimaginably brutal. In 1914, war was simply unimaginable." And so I watched it, and I was thinking how much Bill would have enjoyed it. And then I saw the notification. His longtime friend, Colin Dassault, put it up on Facebook. So let's take a moment and remember Bill, Mr. Stress, at his very best. And in lieu of wandering off into the swamp of our evening's typical concerns, if you wish, the phone lines will be there for you to share your memories or express your feelings if you wish. We've got one caller on right now over on the first line, 304-574-8178. The other line remains open at the moment, 304-663-4676. You can jump in there if you wish. You can send your thoughts to bobkincaid@gmail.com. You can reach out at Bob Kincaid on Twitter, or post over or message over at Bob Kincaid on Facebook. One of the nice things is that Bill frequently heard how much people in this community thought of him. And it is so nice if the tributes can be delivered while one is still alive. And you, all of you, delivered those. And aren't you glad you did? Aren't you glad you did? He lived an American life, quintessentially. Grandson of immigrant grandparents, about whom he talked quite a bit. He worked in the system of what more can we say, capitalist exploitation. At one point in time, Bill repaired ancient turn-of-the-century knitting mills that were so good at what they did that they really couldn't be improved upon. And then, of course, those jobs left in the name of increased corporate profits and free trade. He repaired televisions. And who knows if that had something to do with the problems he later developed with his vision. He also built computers way back when they were nothing compared to what they are now. But he physically built them. He did all these things as a means of supporting that which he most loved, learning and playing the blues. And it has weighed on me that he died alone. And there is not much comfort to be had but to say that he lived his life well, that he was loved by many, and that there are a lot of other people, relatively speaking, who have squandered their time on this planet, wallowing in bitterness, misery, invective, and hatred, where Bill Miller, in his 72 years, you know, as the old poem says, filled every minute with 60 seconds run. So this, then, Stress's Last Call Blues.
Yeah.
Was one hell of a vocalist, make no mistake about it. But I chose that track because of, well, all that harp is Bill. You know, you used to say that they miss playing. You hear that and you understand why. For those of you who want to, you can go over to Colin DeSalt, I apologize for I'm not sure which way it was pronounced, but it's, but you can go to his website and all of the CDs are there. And they're going to use the CD sales to help defray, the costs associated with bidding farewell to Mr. Stress. And let me find the website real quick. By the way, a suggestion coming in from Texas Betsy. She asked, can we? And I said, yeah, nice idea. Henceforward, the Gizmo line is the Stress line. So when you dial in on 304-663-4676, that's the Stress line. Because we put that line in specifically for Bill, because given his visual limitations, he was unable to cope with Skype. And it is Colin DeSalt. Let me make sure I've got the URL right. It is Colin DeSalt. DeSalt. ColinDeSalt.com. Check it out. Let's run over to the non-stress line, stress, but no. I think we've got Kevin out in Colorado. You're there, Kevin?
Yep, I'm here.
How are you?
You know, let me gather myself here.
That's okay. Take all the time you need.
I didn't expect to get emotional. It just hit me the minute you picked up. I was thinking how amazing it is that we of this family, very few of us have met each other in person, and we only know ourselves through our voices. And, you know, yet I can get emotional about, because I did know Bill. I may not be putting it in the best words, but it's when you talk to someone and you just listening to the show, forget about the conversations I've had with him, listening to him through the show, he shared his life's history with us, but he also shared history with us. Far better than most history professors can. Oh, the power of reading. He always talked about that. That was his outlet. And he picked it up at an early age. And it amazes me how a show such as ours can do that. Because I've communicated with a couple people other than Bill over emails and such. I've never met any of you in person. But I know you. And that was what it was like to know Bill Miller, because he wasn't afraid to share anything.
No, and his who you were talking to was who he was.
Exactly.
Now I think he moderated and censored himself a little bit for air purposes, but no, it was pretty much who you hear is who you got.
Well, it's refreshing, because you wouldn't have got to know that Bill Miller on any other show, because most shows, talk shows, aren't set up for that.
No, hey, that's great hearing from you, Bill. That's wonderful. Good to hear from you in Cleveland. Well, that's enough about you. Let's talk about me. I've got one half my brain tied behind my back.
Exactly. And I was lucky enough to be able to share conversations with him and get to know him. He talked a lot about some of the members of the Horn family. I'll let you know that he talked very fondly about his conversations with Agnes when she would answer the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, he always talked about that and how much he appreciated the time she spent talking to him. And he had a lot of respect for both Jims, Jim Denver and Jim West Virginia. And we get to share ourselves on this show. And I don't know, I'm amazed at how transformative something like this is, because had I not known Bill through this show, maybe somewhere in the next few days I might see something in the news about Cleveland Blues Hall of Famer dies, but I wouldn't know anything about him. And I didn't grow up really big into blues, but I learned a lot about it through Bill. And, you know, it just, I was privileged to be able to share the times I did with him.
I thought it was a brilliant idea when you figured out a way to get you both on Friday on the front porch by tying the calls together.
Yep, and I really regret dropping off the show Friday night. Friday was one of those days where I had just had enough of what goes on, and you know, sometimes you got to bail out of the political discussion because you can't take it. You know,
there are certainly nights when you just want to run screaming into the night.
Yeah, I think of the marvelously coherent Diane, how she talks about running screaming with her skirt up, you know, running into the night. And
Kate talking about just throwing her dress over her head.
Yeah. And so, but I just wanted to let you guys know how much various members of the Horn family he would talk about in the conversations I had with him, and how much he appreciated when he had a stroke the number of people that took care of him and walked him through that. And that's why one of the reasons I called so early, right after you started talking, I knew the minute you said something, before you even said who it was, I knew.
Yeah.
And when you played that clip, when you started to play that clip, I was struck, because that was back in 2012.
Right.
If you compare that clip in 2012 to anything from this year, the difference in Bill's voice, I mean, I won't say anything other than this. He knew his time was short. And occasionally he'd make reference to it, but...
No, occasionally he said he wasn't going to mind. He said he found this place where we are and the future we face frightening.
Yeah, I do too, quite honestly. I think it was even a little bit of solace to him that he knew he wouldn't be around to see what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, because, you know, this country has a bad habit of not learning from history. And that's the one thing Bill knew. So Bill did learn from history. We've learned from history through our doctor, and, you know, sometimes I stand back. We just elected a new mayor, which, of course, is a right-winger. We fail to learn because we just made the mistake of electing someone who is going to do the same thing to us that's been done to us in the city before. And we had a chance and a choice not to allow that to happen. But anyway, back to Bill. I can't add too much more than that. I just, I'm not, you know, I'm not even, I don't want this to sound bad. I'm not sad that Bill died in the sense that if there is anything out there, Bill's at peace. One way or the other, Bill's at peace. And he was struggling with a few things, and he doesn't have to struggle with those things anymore. So I can be sad for me, I can be sad for us, that we're not going to be able to hear his insights again on this program, except through the power of what you call the postcard from the past, because they're not only postcards from the past, they're postcards to the future, and maybe someday, 100, 200, 300 years from now, somebody's going to dig up something and find, go to their computer and put it on and be able to hear what we discuss on this show. And maybe then they'll learn from history. But I just want to, I know the one thing Bill would say to all of us, especially to Tom, and the people there in Ohio who helped him out. Names are escaping me at the moment, but they know who they are. He really appreciated the help, and he really appreciated the concern that they gave him. And he... Jug of Punch, he often talked about the meals your wife cooked for him. And I think that was one of Bill's definite enjoyments in life, was a home-cooked meal from your wife. So I just want to include that, because he mentioned that to me often. And, you know, it's these little thoughts. When someone passes away, that we go to, I don't think of the bad times. I don't think about the time Bill got sick to the stroke, other than to think of what the outpouring of concern was for him. And I personally smile at the response that the Horn family gave him, because I don't think you, aside from that day that it happened, I don't think you would have made it without the outpouring of concern and help that people gave him. Because, you know, without this show, who would have known? I don't know if I believe in fate. I don't know if I believe in a lot of things. And belief is one of the most, as you often point out, belief is one of the most dangerous words there is. But, you know, you just think to yourself.
Well, no one knows.
Yeah, well, it's not only that no one knows, it's that I think to myself, it almost was meant to be that he was on the phone with you that day when he stroked out. 30 minutes one way or the other.
Oh, that's, Kevin, that's why I ran back in here in the studio and checked both phone lines to make sure that I hadn't missed a call from him. because I couldn't stand the idea that he might have reached out again and we weren't here.
Yep.
But he didn't.
Well.
And all that I read was that sometime Monday.
You don't know what time or
no.
And by the way, do you know what time of day it was?
No.
By the way, one thing I also wanted to mention: if you do go online and you look up Cleveland Blues Hall of Fame or even Google Bill's name, there are many clips of Bill and his induction into the Cleveland Blues Hall of Fame.
Oh, there are. Yes.
Yeah. So
I mean,
it was
nicely recorded by the CBS affiliate there, and it was an event.
Yep.
I mean, this wasn't some sort of valedictory for a hobbyist.
Yep.
This was Bill was a working musician, and one who brought incredible amounts of joy to thousands upon thousands of people. I mean, over a decade as the house band at the Euclid Tavern, and the Euclid Tavern isn't exactly a little dive that nobody goes in.
No.
And you do not, and I mean, you know your rock and roll, you do not get invited to open for Cream if you're just a guy who busks on the street corner.
No. I went to, while I was listening to that clip, my computer being with accessible software, I went to what's called the National Federation of Blind Newsline, plays newspapers for us online, where we hear it by voice. And I checked the Cleveland Plain Dealer for yesterday and today. I didn't see anything in there. I would appreciate anyone in Ohio, if there is any newspaper articles about him, if you would be so kind as to cut and paste
you know what, yeah, send them to me. BobKincaid@gmail.com, and Kevin, I'll make sure you've got them.
Because I couldn't find anything, and I find it hard to believe that any newspaper wouldn't mention someone from their local Blues Hall of Fame passing away, but there wouldn't be a notice. And my software is notorious for leaving articles out, so, you know.
What there is, folks can send to me. I've got a couple of things already, and I will make sure that you get them, Kevin. You know, everything that you say is a kind and warm and loving testimony to Bill. And what you said is so true, insofar as I don't know if these kind of relationships develop. You know, in the Hannity program or the Limbaugh program. But we have created something here, a space for candor, a space for compassion, a space for camaraderie that really doesn't exist in many other places, and I think that's part of why Bill chose to share so much of his life here. And it sort of validates it in many ways. I mean, so many people have, but this validates the idea of conversation radio. It validates the idea of a radio program creating community of common interests. By the way, for folks who want to do this, Colin DeSalt put together a compilation, a 4-disc set. It's nicely packaged back when Bill had the stroke. And it's still available. You can go, and yeah, Michael in Madison points out that URLs can get really dodgy when you're trying to spell them out on the air. the easiest way to go get that compilation set is Mr. Stress, MRSTRESS, MRStress.net, and it takes you straight to the Stress Relief Project page. No poking around required. Michael says, PayPal button clear as day. And he says, Michael in Madison says, God damn, he'll be missed. I've sat in my car, in my driveway, or a grocery store parking lot, listening to the horn many times because Bill was telling a story and I needed to hear the end of it without interruption. Wow. And the best part of it, I think, is that while people are sending their thoughts and their remembrances, there was no hesitation to let Bill know how precious he was to the community while he was still with us. And so I'm glad of that. I'm glad of that, Kevin.
Yeah. I'll get off the line. I just want to add, I think Carol had a wonderful idea there. My check will be in the mail. It may not get to you until next week, but maybe we can put something together. Not only just have a show on Bill, but maybe even a tribute to Bill of some kind. You know, it's just, there's not much more I can say. It's, you know.
Kevin, I know you guys talked fairly frequently. Did you talk to him after Friday?
No, I thought about it and regretfully didn't do it. Usually after the shows on Friday, when we would hang up, Bill would go pretty much right to bed. So I knew after the show was over on Friday, I thought about calling because I checked out. I listened to the show off and on while I was doing things, but, you know, I...
And by the way, a couple of people have already sent the article in, and I have forwarded it on to you via email, Kevin. It did show up in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, an article by Chuck Yarbrough. Cleveland Music World mourns loss of Bill, Mr. Stress Miller.
I just wish I would do Ohio so I could go to the tavern. And if anyone from Cleveland's listening that normally doesn't listen to the show, man, Bill loved that place. That was his life for a good part of his life. And that's where I think Bill felt the most free, was when he was there at the Euclid Tavern playing. And so, anyway, I will close out and just say, Bill, wherever you're at, if you can hear this, happy travels.
Indeed. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you indeed. Have a good evening. We'll talk soon. Bye now. An evening of remembrance of Bill, Mr. Stress Miller. The article at the Cleveland Plain Dealer is pretty darn good. It covers a lot of Bill's history. Colin told the Cleveland Plain Dealer that his last request, and it was made pretty plain, and Bill even mentioned it on the program, he said, He wanted a New Orleans style funeral parade down 9th and Euclid, and wanted to do it at 5 o'clock at rush hour and tie up the whole city. By God, he'd deserve it. He would deserve it indeed. The way it happened, the details are in the article. Colin DeSalt said he had nurse's aides who came to see him every couple of days, and uncharacteristically, he didn't call her back when she called him on Monday. Tuesday, she showed up and found him deceased. I would guess she probably knew not to call between the hours of 6 and 9 p.m. Also embedded in the Cleveland Plain Dealer article, a musical tribute to Bill from a singer-songwriter named Alex Bevan, with whom Bill worked for some nearly 50 years. Let's check that out real quick.
That's standing on a corner, wearing Paul Butterfield shoes, looking all around for Sonny Boy, hot on the trail of the blues. The neon lights just sizzle, drizzling outside the uke, and the band setting up, getting ready to play. The bartender turn off the juke, and the cigarette smoke is heavy, and the young girls wear the best. Is a blue jean crowd, Cleveland proud, saying, yes, yes, yes. Mr. Stress. Back when the flats were something, before that buzzard flew, there were two big shoulders and a flannel shirt, hot on the trail of the blues. Don't you hear the work song singing? Make it moan. Your feet just got to move when his melody starts gone. Oh, Mike played a piano, and a drummer is just the best. And a blue jean crowd is Cleveland proud, saying, yes, yes, yes. Mr. Stress. Are you ready for a good time? Hear that harp just growl. Are you ready for a great time? Hear Bill Miller howl. Step back in time with me now, to a place of rhythm and blues, where a man laid down a shovel and he is hot on the trail of the blues. Take a minute to remember the place from where you came. Try hard to see the faces and don't forget the names. Where the cigarette smoke was heavy and the young girls wore the best, is a blue jean crowd, Cleveland proud, saying, yes, 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 Mr. Stress.
Mighty fine, mighty fine indeed. And from the article, and Bill told this story on the air as well, the idea or the name Mr. Stress came from his first wife. Bill frequently mentioned on air that his first wife was a psychiatric nurse. And she told Bill one day, coming home from work, that on the unit where she worked, when someone was having a problem, flipping out, the newspaper says, and it was in need of restraint, the call would go out over the intercom
Mr. Stress to room 123. Mr. Stress, room 123.
And that, for some reason or another, tickled Bill's funny bone. And it stuck. So the Stress Relief Project is at mrstress.net. And all those, all the funds raised will go to defray the costs of taking care of Bill's exit. Isaac, who knows his own brand of incorrigible, is encouraging me to tell the Santa Claus story. Bill never told the Santa Claus story. And, well, I'm not going to either. If he didn't feel like working blue on this program, I'm not going to do it in his name. We'll let that be Mr. Stress's little secret. And the story that he shared with a close circle of friends. Let's run over to the Stress line, our first time using that, and talk to Jim out in Denver. Hey, Jim.
What's up, Bob? Really sad news. It was weird because I was, I guess it was a little after 10 my time when you posted it, because it was like, because Malloy's show was over, so I switched. I just said, okay, well, I was on Twitter for a while, and I'm just looking at the open feed and stuff, and there you said it. I mean, then I went over to your website to double check to make sure I didn't misread. And I think I wrote you. I emailed you, whatever the letter's on. What really impressed me about a lot of things, you know, but particularly to his hunger for knowledge and the truth as opposed to most of America. Maybe hopefully it's not most of America. We just take whatever line, you know, corporate/government, which is becoming one, what is that called, fascism?
Yep.
And it's weird. I was listening on Friday, right? In fact, I'm replacing, because you did an extended show. And after about 3 hours, he dropped out.
Kevin and Bill, yeah.
Yeah, so then I called in, and then I was wondering if he was, and then that's the thing, well, was he kind of feeling tired? Then he's 73, or he was 73, you know, I mean, I'm 55, and sometimes I feel tired. You know, it's not like I'm 25 anymore. So I didn't pay any attention to it, and then when I saw that last night, I was just like, whoa. And the weird thing is, this is like we were talking a couple of weeks back, a couple of months or two, about the finality of life, but not only that. Like, if a certain parent doesn't live, your whole DNA situation can change, you know? Do you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Instead of living out west, you might live out east, you might not exist. Your name line, your bloodline could come to an end. I call it just, you know, cosmic gambling kind of, you know, doubling dice. But I always enjoyed him, man, because I would reiterate about his thirst for knowledge, whereas most people just give up and just accept what they're told. But he had a ton of, just insight, and just did not buy. And also, he did not. You know, you correct me if I'm wrong. He definitely did not seem to buy the party line.
Oh no, no, no. See, well, what you're getting at, Jim, is the fact that he had a finely tuned ear, not only for music, but for bullshit. And
yeah.
So he didn't swallow anything whole. And you know, that even goes to his career. Bill, in his prime, could have been plastered all over record stores all over America. They brought him. One of the recording companies brought him, you know, back in the heydays when, you know, you'd buy a vinyl album and it'd have a real slickety cover and credits, and some of them had gatefold styles and the fold opens, whatever, and you know, about 99% of all of that was going to pay for the record company's lobster lunches, and the artists got little or nothing. Next to nothing. Well, the man from the record company walked in and said, boys, y'all going to be big. You're big, I'm telling you. You're really huge. I tell you what, we want to sign you to a contract. Sign here. And Bill said, well, we might do that. Gimme it. And proceeded to read the contract, found out he was going to get ripped off 17 different ways from Sunday, that he'd probably never see a damn dime from it, that he'd basically be working for the record company, and handed him the contract back and told him where to put it sideways. Because he was dedicated to doing his art as art and not for the benefit of some pissant who had no understanding of the genre to which he dedicated himself and which he so thoroughly loved.
No, he kind of reminds me a lot of, did you see that movie that came out, ten months ago. In fact, I went and saw it with my mother, and I was surprised she wouldn't go see it, so once I mentioned it, I was going to see it. James Brown? It was produced by the Rolling Stones, and they funded it. Was it James Brown? Yeah.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, it was James Brown. It was a really good movie. My mother even enjoyed it. Yeah, I like that kind of shit. Get my mother's voice. So my mother enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed it. What was the name of it? I can't remember the name of it right now. I guess in a way that he's out of suffering, because I imagine once you start getting older, and I'm, you know, kind of freaking out, I'm wondering about that, you know, my situation in 20 years, where I'm going to be at.
Well, I don't think it's outside the realm of reason to be doing that. This is the United States, the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, has devolved. There was a little, you know, window where there was a little hope that one might age and die with dignity. That's on the way out the door, Jim. And it's one of the things that bothered Bill. He worried about it. Speaking of movies, this is like the title of another movie. This is No Country for Old Men, or old women for that matter. It is hard to be old in this country, and it is going to get harder.
Try getting quote-unquote work, and then try to piece together, you know, I mean, once you're over 50, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Jesus Christ, we cover everything, Bob. I think you and I are like purveyors of the universe, but, where you're over 50, you smoked or you did smoke, so you might have a heart attack. And I almost listen. What do you mean, might? Eventually, I will have a heart attack and die.
Bill had his when he was 51.
What's that?
Bill had his heart attack when he was 51.
Wow, still lasts another 20-some-odd years.
And he kept playing.
And see, the thing is, the wicked thing about that is, it's just because I saw some corporate news, maybe it was, I tried to stay away from Fox News, maybe not, but where they're almost talking about, well, you know, if somebody dies early, and that's more money for the Social Security, when, you know, all they have to do is take the goddamn cap off, and I don't mean to be turning Bill's
I don't think he would object, Jim.
Memory into a political thing, but I don't know. It's kind of an idea, kind of politics thing, and just what I see wrong.
Well, remember when Bill had his stroke in 2013, he was on the verge of being thrown out of his home. He was brokered in the Ten Commandments. And, this was a man who had a following in the thousands. And I guess, you know, sort of, and if you mentioned his name to anybody around Cleveland, they'd go, oh, yeah, man, oh, he's awesome. Whatever happened to him? And see, this is, I mean, he was over 65, you know, he was supposed to have his Social Security and his Medicare, and that was supposed to make things okay. But if Colin DeSalt hadn't stepped in and gotten him that apartment in the Musician's Towers, we wouldn't have had him for the year and a half that we had him extra.
He would have been up the proverbial shit creek without a paddle.
In a barbed wire canoe, absolutely.
Hey, ain't that America? You and Dave.
Well, that's the whole point, you know. Bill would appreciate this little line of reasoning. Social Security was brought in because America had a horrible, and of course, there's nobody around from then, so nobody bothers to remember because our lifespans are short. America had a horrible, debilitating, tragic, agonizing problem with elder poverty. If you were old and you didn't have family to lean on, you were screwed. And you died, miserable and alone. Social Security was meant to ameliorate that. But naturally, because Republicans are the godless, soulless, motherless things that they are, they can't worry about human well-being. They're worried about the money. The money. Oh, but what about the poor little sweet, precious money? Money, 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 money.
Well, it's just 3 or 4 days ago I heard them goddamn fucking Republicans bitching and moaning about, oh, we've got to cut. The budget, blah, blah, blah. First thing, Social Security. Don't touch the defense. Don't touch the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I know. No, because, you know, America won't be worth living in if we can't make lots of bombs to drop on brown people. That's Merca.
And don't cut all the tax cuts that these corporate MFers get for not only fouling the air in the water in our very existence and bribing and going down the hill, going to the highway to hell. All right, well, I'm going to get off the line. I think I had enough to say. I mean, did you get my message? I left one on you for you on Twitter. Maybe you did. I think you did. I don't know.
Yes. I checked my Twitter and my Facebook feed throughout the evening. Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't keep you up till 6, but you know.
Well, I mean, I tried to sleep, but I just couldn't.
Yeah, you lost a dear friend. We all lost a dear friend. I think, like you said, the Han Malloy family can appreciate. And also, like you said, whenever know, you can be as stoic as you want, and it's there's still that human element. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was one of the great things about Bill.
And Kevin just wrote in and said, "Tell Jim Bill wouldn't mind a bit. In fact, he'd be right there beside you, chiming in on how right you are about it all." Indeed.
That's great. All right, I'm gonna let somebody else get in.
All right, you take it easy. We'll talk soon, Jim.
Mm.
Bye now. Over from the stress line, that's our buddy Jim, formerly of Louisiana Stan, now out in Denver. Going back to the phone lines in a minute, that means the stress line is open. We've got someone on the other line. We'll go there momentarily. Just a couple of quick trips over to the email real quick. Notes coming in from all over the place. Sylvia says, "So bummed. Such sad news. He was my favorite correspondent. Friday on the front porch won't be the same without his memories and sense of humor. Thanks to you for sharing him with your listeners. Maybe he and BB will jam in heaven." Edward in Dallas says, "Thoughts of Bill are with me. I always enjoyed listening to him on the horn." The marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan, said, "I just now followed Carol's lead and made a contribution to the horn via PayPal in memory of Mr. Stress. I feel an incredible sadness in losing a person I have never met that knew through a remarkable radio community." And a tweet came through in the evening from a friend of Bill's in Cleveland. "Bill kept telling me, you knew him better than anyone else and felt we ought to talk. So sad he's gone." Yeah. We all are. I'm hatching a plan here. I don't know exactly whether or how it can work out. Bill's memorial is Tuesday evening in Cleveland. I'm thinking, you know, it's only 6 hours from here to there. I'm thinking maybe if I can reach out to Colin, see if maybe they might be interested in, if they would be amenable to, if I can get up there, me streaming it out for all of Bill's friends, wherever they might be. Hell, there might even be bandwidth enough to do it video and not just audio. Timing's going to be a little dodgy next week. It's going to be a very busy week, or not next week, but the week of the 1st of June. Our doodle graduates high school on that Friday. Got family coming in, but I think we could wrap up. We have to do that weekend, get home, leave Tuesday morning, do the be at the memorial Tuesday evening, stay in some, I don't know, Super 8 motel or something, and turn around and come back Wednesday. Hell, maybe even be on the air Wednesday evening. That might be a tall order, but hell, it might be possible too. Who knows? It's worth pondering. Let's run over to the other line. Is that you, Jim?
It is I. How are you, sir?
Well, under the circumstances, you know.
I well understand. We have exchanged some certain emails today, and I just want to express my sincere condolences to the memory of this man who brought a lot of joy, a lot of knowledge, and his own quest for knowledge, to me, was just incredible. And I spent many enjoyable evenings hearing Bill reflect upon the things in his life. You know, Bob, I have a problem with funerals, and I don't mean to be offensive here. A lot of funerals are attended by people. Well, 50% go just to see who attends, and the other half goes because they might have felt guilty not having said as a person in life, but have come to try to say something in death. But in this particular case, any service or memory of Dr. Stress will be an exception to that rule.
I think so. I admit I have my own quantum of, well, if not guilt, remorse, because I never got up to Cleveland to meet him personally. And I wanted to do that. Ferg poked his head in the door earlier today and said, "Mr. Stress?" And I said, "Yeah." And he just said, "Man, I really wanted to go up and play guitar for him and see if he could show me a little bit on the harp."
Well, that would have been a great thing for him to have been able to do so. But, and I'll close on this, you know, I think it's, I don't know where it comes from. Our footprints on the sands of time. And I left, and you know, I believe that Dr. Stress left many visible footprints in the minds and hearts of a great number of people by way of you and just the kindnesses that were shown to this man while he lived. And I thank you for taking the call.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Have a good evening. Bye now.
Goodbye.
Jim has a profound sense of decorum and compassion in moments like this. And he's right. He's right about the attendees to funerals. I was thinking earlier today that where the memorial service is concerned, even if Bill can't get his New Orleans parade down Euclid Avenue, which I really think he should have, by the way, there will be a hell of a lot more folks at his memorial, for instance, than there were at J. Edgar Hoover's. That's a fact. Hey, Carol Baker, how are you?
I'm fine, Bob. Can you hear me?
I got you great.
Okay, good, because I can barely hear you.
Oh, I don't know why.
Whatever you just did, that's better.
Okay, wonderful.
Anyway, I just wanted to say I'm not a big believer in the afterlife, as you well know, but I do believe that there is a universal consciousness out there, and that Bill is stardust out there.
Yeah, he is. Whatever is in us, and I'm not going to get all new agey any more than you would, but it's a fact. Whatever is in us, each and every one of us, was present at the Big Bang. And that's really all there is to it.
I just love the fact that Bill really had a family in all of us.
He did, and the thing is, he knew that, Carol. He knew that. And he treated us as, he considered us to be family. And
that he did.
One of the things, I hadn't mentioned it yet, but a while back, before we got the latest internet connection, when we were suffering through the long hell of dealing with Shentel cable, I'd be struggling and buffered up and miserable, and all of a sudden the phone would ring, and I'd pick it up, and Bill would be there, and I'd just hear this voice on the other end go, "Cocksuckers can't make the internet work again tonight, can they?" "Nope, Bill, they can't. I hate the bastards, don't you? I despise them, Bill." He said, "Well, I know what a pain in the ass it is when the equipment doesn't work. I won't bother you, but I just wanted to let you know I'm out here sympathizing." And it would pick my spirits up. Because I would. I'd be saying, God, black stag and blue nose, not Paul Frazz, the son of a prince. And sons of bitches. Yeah. Bumpuses! Right? Yeah.
Well, he loved us, and we loved him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a bad legacy.
No. Are you kidding? You know what? There's probably not one in a million people have the legacy that Bill Miller had. There probably aren't one in a million Americans who can touch the people Bill Miller touched.
I was watching those videos. I was stunned. I had no idea he could sing like that.
Oh, he was a showman. And he had the soul of a Catskills comic too.
Yes, he did.
With the terrible one-liners and the
the comment that his first wife had the decency to divorce him rather than take the obvious route and kill him in his sleep. I loved that. I thought that is vintage Bill.
But I was
surprised, you know. I mean, I knew about his history, but I didn't know about his intense love of Dixieland jazz, because, I mean, that's what I was raised on. My father loved it. We had boxes and boxes and boxes of vinyls, and on the rare day off that he had, he would blast our house with Pete Fountain and Al Hurt. And I know Bill is somewhere listening to these names going, yes, she gets it. And I didn't know that was, I mean, because jazz is a genre that is very broad spectrum. And to know that was really his first love just made me feel so much closer to him. Because my dad would have loved Bill.
Oh, and see, I mean, he really was outgoing and forthcoming with his history. He painted for us a word picture, Carol, of what it was for the, you know, the little white kid from the projects in Cleveland the first time he heard the music. And it couldn't have had more of an impact on him had it been a Heavenly Chorus, and for that matter, it may as well have been. It changed him. It rewired his soul.
Well, and that's just it. That's what I learned at a very early age. The blues isn't about pain. It's about catharsis. It's about working out your pain. And I've always known it. For a white girl, I've always known it. And to hear Bill talk about it, I was sitting there going, yeah, I mean, and I know that it was such a, it was such an anathema to see a white guy who could play and sing like that. And I mean, there was some brother in that soul.
Yeah, there, and you know, the goodwill that was involved there too. I mean, he couldn't afford the prejudice.
No, and that is the thing about being poor. None of us can. It's what makes us liberals, Bob.
Well, yeah, and it's what makes this community this community. I was saying earlier, you know, I don't know if the people who sit around listening to Hannity or Limbaugh feel the way that we feel about each other.
Of course not, Bob, because we talk to each other. We don't talk at each other. We talk to enrich each other, not to enrich ourselves. You don't do this to be a millionaire. You do this to tell the truth, and you tell the truth because you have to, not because you're going to necessarily change anybody's mind, but because your soul will break if you don't. And that's why Bill played music.
Yeah,
it's all the same thing. It's all interconnected. It's what makes us all the same. It's why we simultaneously love each other and hate each other and get frustrated with each other.
You ever, this is going to seem like a strange segue, Carol, but you've seen Jerry Maguire, right? The movie.
Oh God, yes.
You know the scene where the really sleazy, smarmy sports agent walks up and tries to get a hug from one of his clients?
Yes.
Well, when you said we try to enrich each other, not enrich ourselves, I had this flash, this mental image of Rush Limbaugh giving some sweaty hug to some ditto head. And now I have to shower with bleach.
We all do, because that shit don't wash off, baby.
Oh, God, no. No, I don't think you can boil it away.
But now I would just get so tickled, because after I would hang up, inevitably it would be Bill right behind me laughing at something that I'd said.
Oh, because he loved it.
And if I made him happy, then that made me happy.
And you know what? He never issued a word. The other way. He always had good things to say.
About everybody.
About everybody who participated in this conversation.
Yes.
I mean, he would talk to me privately about the emailers. You know, about, you know, so-and-so said this and how smart they were and how intelligent and how perceptive this entire community is. And he was right.
He was.
And he was right in the middle of it.
And I feel bad that I haven't been part of this family long enough to have appreciated how good he sounded. When you were playing that first clip, I was like, I mean, I know that's Bill, but he sounded so much more connected. You could tell he felt better.
Oh, he did. And
I miss that, and I feel bad that I wasn't around for all of that.
Well, he alluded to Dr. Bill's Prism American History series, which went on for several years, and I mean, he was plugged into that stuff because, you heard on the clip, he said, you know, I don't know that much about the founding and the revolution, or the revolution and the founding, but he sat there just soaking it up.
It absolutely entranced
him.
I'm so addicted to Dr. Bill now.
And he had another one of his epic conversations today. Horst called in from Taiwan, and those two get going, the doors of perception will open. Yeah, it was it's amazing, and Bill enjoyed Mr. Stress enjoyed Dr. Bill and what he brought immensely, and the thing is, I'm trying to remember, and now that I do think of it, you know, it was at least, you know, if Stroke was 2013, it was like 2011, I think, maybe, when we first started talking.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if he said how it was he found us, but he did. Maybe it was back when, I don't think it was iTunes. But he did find us and immediately became a caller and immediately became a near regular. And you know, there was always something he brought to the table. You know, the fact that he loved the history of the Civil War. He was fascinated with the Korean War, because, well, he had never been able to serve in the military.
Yeah.
And frankly, he probably would have been a great general, maybe not so much as a private. What do you mean you want me to swab out the literature? Fuck you! Yeah, no.
I swear, when I heard Bill passed away, I kept thinking, today would be the day that I wished I smoked pot, because I would love to just fire up a fatty for Bill.
Here, yeah, but yeah, right, but there is the plea agreement, so we understand. And, yeah.
There is that plea agreement, yeah. But God, I mean,
and
I
witness protection and all of that. Right.
Yeah, my father got popped for a pound of wheat back in '46. Just dying.
Yeah. See, nobody else has that story here.
Nobody. It was priceless. He would say stuff like that, and I would just do spit takes.
Yeah, well, there goes another monitor.
Yeah, what the hell. But, Bill, wherever you are, buddy, I love you. We all love you.
Oh, we do. We do indeed. This is you know, all of this, the calls, the emails, this is very helpful for me because I don't know how to explain this, Carol, but way back of what seems a very long time ago, I was a child. You know, there's that line from Charles and Mary Lamb where they write, lawyers once, I suppose, were children too. And that is the epigram to at the beginning of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
But now this isn't lawyery stuff or legal, but when I was a little boy, I had an AM radio. FM really hadn't taken off.
Right.
And it sat there by my bedside, and I remember a couple of times when I was a little tiny kid and I was sick and stuck in bed and just laid there listening to the radio. And after a while, you know, and this was a classic era of DJ'd radio. And granted, it was just a little small market affair, but you know what a musical history the Muscle Shoals area has now.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And I would sit there and I would listen to the music, but I would also listen to the DJs. And I wondered how radio worked. Because, you know, there was a cable that went into the back of the TV. We already had cable back then. It made a little sense, but, you know, here was this box. And I would listen to the DJs and try to, and my imagination ran away with me. You know, how did it work in there? How did the music start there and come out here and the voices and the talking? And it was so immediate and it required my mind. And so I put my imagination to work imagining the people doing the radio. And in not too much longer an amount of time after that, you know, I got my first job in high school and it was as a pimply faced gospel DJ. Now, most DJs have fans or groupies or whatever, and radios groupies, especially with rock and roll. And well, as a pimply faced gospel radio DJ, my groupies, and you know, I was 16 years old, my groupies were, you know, septuagenarians who wanted to hear Jesus, This Is Jimmy just one more time. And you haven't been around long enough to hear Jesus, This Is Jimmy. I'll leave it to you to look it up on your own, and then you'll understand what, you know, where the madness comes from.
You know I will.
But I'd sit that play, and it imposed a sense of kind of responsibility, if you can imagine. You know, not the FCC kind of don't say booger on the air responsibility, but the idea of being connected to people. And then I came back to this starting in about 2003, and especially because, well, you know, rock and roll radio is not quite so, or music radio isn't quite so interactive because, you know, you talk, you play the songs, and, you know, you'll pick up the phone and play Jesus, This Is Jimmy, thank you, goodbye. And
yeah, well, it isn't like that anymore.
No, it isn't. You can call a computer or whatever, but anyway. So turning around and coming back to talk-based radio, I found myself doing the exact opposite of what I had done when I was looking at that little Montgomery Ward green vinyl-clad AM radio back in the 1970s. And I began to imagine the people who call in. And I do that. Whatever people may imagine about me, I'm imagining my imagination runs away with me with every single person who calls this program.
Oh, good, because I'm so much prettier in your imagination. And thinner.
Oh, but the voice. But it was like that with Bill, with Mr. Stress. I was horrified when I tried to imagine what his circumstances were when the stroke came. And
right.
Then when Colin and others helped get him into the musicians' towers, you know, and he would talk about his computer problems and things like that. Yeah, I built a little virtual world inside my head of Bill's universe. And on those moments when he would get out and about in Cleveland, The one in particular that grabbed me lately was his description of how much he loved that Vietnamese coffee with chicory that he got somewhere around his apartment. And I guess he would get out and go down there and have coffee and chicory and maybe a banh mi sandwich or whatever. But sitting there, I would just imagine Bill drinking his, and that Vietnamese style coffee is sweet too, I think. Just imagining him gingerly bringing it to his lips to make sure that he wasn't going to get burnt on the first sip. And, you know, how he would talk about the absolutely disastrous choices that we made that led to us getting into Vietnam. And it was a world. And now, damn it, Carol, now that world's gone.
Yeah.
And it kind of fucks you up.
Yeah, it does. It does. But, you know, there are a lot of people listening who were so enriched by having him be a part of their life, even after the stroke. And, you know, he would say the damnedest things. And I kept laughing, going, come on, Bill, this century, you know. And I'd hear you trying to reel him back in. But the man just loved his history.
Oh, he did. And
I couldn't begrudge him that.
And it's kind of like what Dr. Bill says. He said he'll be talking about current events, and he'll say, now let's return to saner times, you know, the 18th century. And I think there was truth in that for Bill, too. There was something comprehensible, as much horror as there was in those periods of history with which he found himself fascinated. There was somehow or another something essentially understandable about it, and we seem to be going at a faster and faster clip toward absolute absurdism, where nothing means what we thought it meant anymore. The idea of self-government has become downright unfashionable.
True.
You know, the things for which we fought in the past, well, we don't fight for those things anymore. No, we fight for oil. We fight for corporate hegemony in regional power games. And it's not reassuring.
No, it isn't. But in a point of comfort, I will say this about Bill. He always had regrets that he hadn't become a teacher. And I want to reassure him that he was.
He was, indeed. Thank you, Carol. But
anyway, Bob, I'm going to let you talk to the rest of the family. I just wanted to call in and express my condolences and a few thoughts.
I'm glad you did. I'm very glad you did. Have a good evening, Carol.
You too. Bye. Bye-bye.
The one and only Carol Baker. So, at this point in time, both lines are open, 304-574-8178, or the stress line, 304-663-4676. Tim wrote in and he said, he quotes the paragraph about Bill having been sick for a while. He says, made me remember how the Hornies and the Loyalists back 2 years ago mobilized us to help Bill. Obviously, I couldn't do a thing, but just listening to our family help him showed me how close we truly are. And to be quite frank, I loved it when Bill called in during Friday on the front porch and the stress line was reserved for Bill. His insight was spectacular, and I loved listening to him. There's a heaven Bill's performing away, thank goodness. You have hours of his phone calls, and those memories of Bill will last forever. Rest and be one with nature, Bill. We all love you. let's see here. Jenny in Wisconsin says, I've been crying on and off all day. He was like the granddad whose stories I never heard. Well, remember what Gertrude Stein said. Friends are the family we make for ourselves. And thanks very kindly going out in the ongoing effort to have a show, have a show on Bill for this memorial for him. Thanks to Jack in Shreveport. And thanks to Darcy and the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan. Thank you, Harold. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Chris. Thanks, one and all. Kelly with a note, Bill left a bigger footprint in this life than most of us ever will. She says, except for you, Bob, you have a really big footprint. I don't know. I don't think I can ever touch as many people as Bill did. Kelly says, I have found you very addictive. I find myself hurrying home from work so I can get the show started at 6 p.m. That's crazy. All caps. Nah, that's just this community. And it has a lot more to do with the community itself than it does with me. Back over to the Harold line, the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program. Is that you, John?
Yeah, I just want to take a second and give my condolences.
Well, thank you very kindly.
Yeah, I have not been part of your group for long, if I can be pulled to include myself to it. But,
You're part. You're part of the family. You're stuck with us.
But I've always found with people like Bill that they give you a glance at a window in the past that so many of us forget about. They forget about the prices that guys like him paid to get us to this point, and sometimes it infuriates me that, you know, the political and social figures of our time are so willing to just piss that away. And, it makes me a little angry sometimes, you know. It's like, this, you know, guys like him, they create art, they strive for equality, they activist things. And then, you know, you wake up one morning and you've got people trying to get rid of your Social Security or burn the country to the ground or do something crazy and stupid.
Right, because they're worried about the money and not the people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, see, I like listening to guys like him because there are for them there was a time when you could actually sit down and actually think. Things didn't happen in an instant. Nowadays, you know, if I may be so cold and cruel, but nowadays you cut a fart, it's on Facebook.
Well, right, you know, and it is immediately replaced 15 seconds later by someone else's fart.
Right, and it's like nowadays you don't, people, here, let me see if I can say this right. It used to be that people would ask you, what do you think about something? About politics or economics or racial tensions, whatever, what do you think? But nowadays, everything is so fast that there is no time to think. You know, you get your wolf blitzers and crap like you did last night. What do you feel? That's all they want to know. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about this situation down in Waco? How do you feel about this situation in Iraq?
Feelings. So, nothing more than feelings. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And guys like Bill could occasionally act like an anchor that could hold you back a little bit and say, wait a minute, dudes, there was a time and place when, you know, for all the crap we're screaming about Iraq, he was around with Vietnam. And so for him, the song is a repeat from an earlier time, and you can gain so much insight and knowledge if people could just pull the crap out of their ears and listen. And I enjoyed listening to him because, like I said, you get that little taste, that little glimpse into a time that's past. And you gotta tip your hat to a life well lived, and damn it, you have got to listen to when these guys open their mouths. If you don't, you miss out. You miss out big time.
Well, it has been said that the key to wisdom is not making the same mistake over and over again. And the way that we, the best way not to make the same mistakes over and over again, is to actually listen to the people who were around when they were made the first or second or third or 15th time, and hope you get it right this time through. And that's what I'm talking about, John, when I say that that human lifespans are entirely too short. We screw ourselves because we have no ability. I mean. Well, like I was talking about that BBC show, and it's fictionalized, of course, but it's based on historical data called Our World War. There were elements of it that were a bit presumptuous, because you would never have known that to the right of the British right flank was the French Fifth Army. For all you knew, there were no French in Belgium at the time. But the point is, it was even in the UK, and this is a war that was 100. It was just 100 years ago, just only.
Yeah.
And it has been utterly eclipsed. There are probably more people in England who know about the screwed up dust up over the Falklands Islands under Margaret Thatcher than there are who would know what happened at Mons or Verdun or the Marne. And then there's the United States, John. Verdun, is that one of them designers?
They forget that there was a time in history, not that damn, in fact, of the First World War really was the final capstone of the way of life, where before that, the Battle of Waterloo, you had people living in the villages and stuff who went up on top of Preaching Hill and sat there, brought out the picnic baskets and the sunshade and stuff, and sat there and took bets on who was going to win, because the armies were fighting armies. First World War was really the first major, First World War and a bit of the Crimea War before that. But it was the first time that we went into this thing called total war.
And the reason I mention that is because we lose the perspective on it. And it was that perspective which I think absolutely grabbed, grabbed Bill Miller by the lapels and held him there.
Yeah, like Carol says, he was a teacher. He may not have had a certificate or anything like that, but that viewpoint and perspective is incredibly valuable. I remember when I was a teenager, I would be sitting on the front porch of this a friend of mine, and his father, he was a coal miner, and he would sit there and he would tell you about, his favorite saying? He says, "Do you want to know how far it is to hell?" I'd be like, "No." He says, "Quarter mile," because he'd be talking about going down into the mines and stuff.
Yeah.
He says, and we in the modern world, with the technology and the Facebook and the Twitters and stuff like that, I know I have a problem sometimes trying to visualize that world anymore.
I think we have a hard time visualizing a lot of the world, and I think.
I think it was easier for
Mr. Stress to visualize a world gone by than the modern one. I know that's the case for me. because one, you know, those industrial horrors once existed here in the United States, and they existed in plants and factories and mines and mills. Well, we have in a way sanitized ourselves of all of that by sending all of that work overseas. So
yeah.
So it becomes damn nigh impossible to visualize one human being working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, standing on their feet with only a few minutes of breaks along the way, and somehow drawing a bright line between that existence and it ain't a life. At best, it's an existence, and these gadgets that fill our pockets now.
Yeah, well, I had a chance to listen to a little bit of Dr. Bill today before I pissed out on the rest of it, but his conversation with Horace, I mean, that was the theme that was running through a lot of that conversation. We are entering into a world that a guy like Bill would be totally at sea with, because there's nothing real there. Everything's smoke and mirrors. Everything's, the iPhone that you're holding in your hand, 95% of the people that hold that damn iPhone have no clue at the amount of what you could politely call slave labor that went to make the damn thing. Oh, I got it cheap. I go to Walmart. I bought a T-shirt for $5, for $4.99, or fat guys like me who have to pay the extra $2 and get it for $7.99. But it is so damn difficult for us to make the connection between why is it so cheap? And guys like Bill can give you that little momentary glimpse in the past where, no, back when he was a kid, he didn't have a closet full of stuff. He didn't have 25 or 50 sprinkled shirts sitting on a cabinet. You might have had 5 shirts, 10 shirts. You kept care of them because you weren't rolling in money. That, to me, is one of the great the great honors that a guy like Bill can bring to you, is to maybe momentarily remind us that the way we live was not always this way, and what we do now may not even be considered normal. Maybe there's something wrong with this constant scrambling for consumption and, oh, I need a new pair of shoes. I'm Carrie Bradshaw. I need a new pair of shoes, and I have 45 pair already. Well, imagine a time when guys like Bill were coming up. You'd be damn lucky if you had 2 pair of shoes, one for Sunday and one for the rest of the week. And that was an insight that I think that was very valuable to, talk to this guy about. You get that glimpse of the past. And it's a powerful thing.
Well, Cindy just wrote in from the Great Northwest, and she says, history repeats, and Bill said so. She then notes, and this is pretty profound, don't worry about how little history the younger folk remember. The bad old days are coming around again, and they'll get their chance to learn them firsthand.
Yeah, she's probably correct. The only damn problem is how many times can you make the same mistake before you make it and then you can't recover from it? That's the big question mark. You talked about he was worried about the future. Well, hell, let's look at it. It's like the damn article I read today. That I actually tried to call in Dr. Bill earlier when I came on, because I read this article before that frosted my backside. Because here's this guy, because L.A. passes this minimum wage law, goes $15 an hour. And this highfalutin Forbes economist guy is just going all off on it. And he's talking about, everybody's trying to get a just wage, and just wages don't work because some people get wages and the rest will lose their jobs. It's the market determines all these things. And I'm going, holy son of a sick cabinet. This SOB is standing there worshiping this great, powerful market, but it's nothing but a damn construct that people made out of, you know, made out of government. Those markets don't exist. And, you know, it just, you know, and again, like I said, you go back and then I heard what you were talking about with Bill.
Yeah.
He would be able to tell you, he'd be able to go back and tell you, yeah, well, you know, back in the days when he was growing up, you had things like unions, you had things like worker rights. And those things should be spoken of today with guys like him, who would say, hey, I remember a time when I could go and my daddy or my mama could go and work a job. Most people suspect that it was daddy's, but you know, I could go work a job, mama could stay home, take care of the kids and the house, and we still had spending money. Now, where's that voice going to be coming from now?
Exactly. John, very good conversation. I appreciate it.
No trouble.
You have yourself a good evening.
Fairly well. Bye-bye.
Right, bye now. From somewhere along the Great American Road, that's our buddy John. Both lines are open if you want to participate in the memorialization of our good friend Bill Miller, Mr. Stress. Don't worry, we'll jump right back into the swamp tomorrow evening. But a person like Bill, well, he's worth a whole lot more than any 3 hours. But I thought he should have, at the very least, this 3 hours. Kelly noting, excellent show. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you. I thought we'd take another little break. I mentioned the Hall of Fame induction, the Cleveland Blues Hall of Fame. This is Bill's portion of it. Enjoy.
And your webs all over town.
William John Miller was born a few seconds past midnight on January the 1st, 1943. As was the custom at that time, the next day's Cleveland Plain Dealer featured a photo and a story featuring Baby Bill and his mother, the first recorded birth in Cleveland in that difficult wartime year. Bill's dad was a sometime theatrical agent, promoter, and violinist who frequently brought musicians into the home and first sparked Bill with the lure of show business. By no means wealthy, Bill grew up in the integrated neighborhoods of Cleveland's Near East Side. Bill's parents divorced when he was two, and for a while he lived at the Catholic Children's Home in Parma. Bill's first musical obsession was with New Orleans jazz. He took up clarinet and started hanging out in Cleveland's jazz clubs. In the mid-1950s, when Bill was growing up, local radio stations would play blues records as part of their regular programming. Bill heard songs by Slim Harpo, Muddy Waters, and Bobby Bland, and interest in the blues was already percolating beneath the surface. In 1965, Bill heard the first album by the groundbreaking Butterfield Blues Band. He had already begun fooling with the harmonica, and now his course was set. The first Mr. Stress Blues Band was formed in 1966. The term Mr. Stress derives from a code used in psychiatric hospitals to announce that a patient has become out of control and needs to be subdued. The band's first official gig was at the Coffee House on East 115th and Euclid. Though the Coffee House didn't last very long, the band would spend many years performing within 100 yards of that spot. In 1972, the band began what was to become a six-year gig at the Brick Cottage. In 1978, they moved a few yards up Euclid Avenue to the Euclid Tavern, where they held court for 19 more years. For over 40 years, Bill's bands have provided a training ground for musicians from the Cleveland area. many whom have gone on to national and even worldwide prominence. In recent years, Bill has curtailed his activity due to macular degeneration and increasing loss of eyesight that has left him unable to drive. Currently, he performs as a featured member of Alan Green's band. Recently, Bill has told his friends he plans to retire after nearly 45 years in the music business. We'll see.
We heard a we had a nice long track of Bill's harp playing. Let's see if we can find something of a more with a little bit more of his vocal qualities.
Thank you.
see, the funny thing about human relationships is that very few of us ever know anybody for the entirety of a life. And we tend to know people as we come to them or they come to us. And so the Bill that I know is not necessarily the Bill we've been listening to. I know a guy who wanted to talk politics and history and was self-effacing enough that, you know, he kind of had to be coaxed into talking about his life in music. He didn't define himself by any of those things. But because we only know people as they come to us, we struggle, I think, to know people as they were. And the little snippets that Bill would share with us about, evenings watching a gin bottle fall inexorably toward empty, while he played and sang. There's no doubt but what he knew how to enjoy life. And he is gone at age 72. And maybe he arguably could have had more if he had lived an upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Christ-centered life and didn't smoke and didn't drink or carry on or cuss or use foul language and was in the church, in through the church door every time they opened it up. But then you begin to get into value judgments. What does it, what's the phrase from Hamlet's soliloquy? The calamity of so long life? Yeah. I mean, someone posted in the chat room a few minutes ago a lyric from a fairly well-known Pretenders song in which Chrissy Hynde sings, and she, of course, is a Cleveland woman. I was feeling kind of ethereal because I'm precious. I had my eye on your imperial. You're so precious. Now, Howard the Duck and Mr. Stress both stayed trapped in a world they never made, but not me, baby. I'm too precious. Fuck off. Yeah, that was real edgy back when it came out in, what, late 70s, early 80s? But Bill told his Chrissy Hynde story one evening. And one of... And Bill knew Chrissy. Chrissy knew Bill. They were part of the scene in Cleveland. And she went on to massive fame and fortune with the Pretenders. But at one point in time, she was just Chrissy from Cleveland. Or from some neighborhood. And Bill had a sister. And Bill's sister died of ovarian cancer. And Chrissy, I guess, feeling her oats, patiently explained to Bill that ovarian cancer, it was all in her head. And Bill, who adored his sister, became so enraged that he said that evening on the program that he was about fit to punch her lights out. Yeah, that Mr. Stress. Or the Mr. Stress who talks about the fact that he would get done playing gigs at 3, 4 in the morning and felt it to be the better part of valor to go home with a pacemaker in his pocket. He might have the night's gate in hand. And there might be people who would like to relieve him of same. These are passages from real life. And Bill lived it. And we're gonna miss him something fierce. I mean something fierce. It's gonna, you know, for years and years and years on this program, I didn't have caller ID. I had no idea who was calling in. I've got a pretty good memory, and I can memorize an area code pretty quick. And now we've got that. And I knew when it was going to be Bill. And I knew it was going to be fun. And, well, damned if I'm not going to miss that. Gerald, with a note a little bit ago, said, I didn't know Bill. I had never met him other than on the air, but I considered him a friend. Bill was the kind of guy that I think anyone could grow to love. I'd like to think that you, Bob, and the entire Horn community can take some sort of comfort in knowing that Bill really enjoyed what the show was about and the people who participate in it. I honestly feel that Bill looked forward to conversations he had with you, Bob, and shared a sense of family with each and every one of us. And he did. He did. And he told us time and time again. And that is a validation. Hell. You think Sean Hannity's community gets that kind of validation? No. No. Limbaugh? I'd rather have known Bill for as long as I did on air than be Rush Limbaugh for even one miserable second. And believe you me, it would be a miserable second. You know, if you were Rush Limbaugh, you'd have a drug problem too. Bill talked about that too. Made no bones about the fact that he enjoyed smoking one of those hand-rolled cigarettes, as he described it. But he drew a line. He said he never touched heroin because he said, if something like that could take down a genius like Miles Davis or Billie Holiday, he said, I knew I didn't have anywhere near the strength to deal with it. So I hope, well, you know, we don't have a Viking longboat we can set fire to and sail out into the fjord. Although Bill probably would have liked that too. But I hope in these 3 hours, Bill, that we've done you justice. You were a friend. You were a raconteur. You were a scholar. But most of all, Bill, you were family. A part of this little Horn family commune congregation. We few. We happy few. Thanks, everybody, for joining in on the memorial. Back tomorrow evening. But for now, I'll just say, as Bill did, I'll get out of the way here. Good night.